Thanks for tuning in to the Steep Angle Podcast. My guest today is a huge advocate for interscholastic cycling and getting kids involved in the sport of mountain biking. She was an ambassador for Live Bikes and is someone that I keep meaning to go out riding with. Please help me welcome Sue Raleigh.
Welcome to the Steep Angle Podcast, the podcast fueled by a life of powdered slopes, ripping good single tracks, healthy living, and the tools and people that help us along the way. Energized by motion, exploration, and the celebration of life, we hope you find inspiration in what we share. Be courageous, be curious, and chase your adventure. I'm your host, Daniel, and this is Steep Angle.
So we're on, we're live.
Okay.
Strange times we're living in. How are you doing, by the way?
I'm doing well, actually. I think, I was thinking about it the other day. I think I'm probably more introverted than most people think I am. I think professionally I'm always outgoing, but I spend a lot of time alone anyway. And as you probably know, I ride alone a lot. So, other than worrying about a lot of people, I'm doing fine. I've worked from home before, so that's not that complicated for me. And
yeah.
I tend to be very structured and organized. So I get up every day and I take a shower and put on my work clothes and sit at my little desk at home and work for a while. And then, do my physical therapy and some other things and go back to work for a while. So I actually am enjoying it. I sure miss 850 kids at school.
Well, Mateo's missing it a lot.
Oh, I can't even. I mean, yeah. I've talked to quite a few parents, and I know kids are just really, a lot of kids are really struggling, especially, Mateo's an only kid. And I think kids with siblings at least have that, but then they just fight over the computer and everything else.
So. Yeah, and drive their parents crazy. Pretty much.
How's Christine hanging in there?
She's hanging in there. She's starting to get a little cabin feverish, little stir crazy.
Yeah.
She does make fun of me because I too get dressed in the morning,
yeah.
And she's like, "What are you doing?
Yeah.
You're putting on real clothes.
I'm like, I have to, I don't sit around in pajamas anyway. I'm not a very lazy person that way. And I don't have a TV. So for me, it's like, I have a desk where my computer is and I sit there and work, and I just feel better if I'm dressed and ready for doing that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of. Feel normal kind of right. Thing. Yeah. Have you been getting out at all riding?
Yeah. I mean, now that the weather's finally better, I've pretty much been trying to get out. I mean, I still think it could be a little warmer. I realize the older I get, the more I want the temperatures to be around 80. But I have been riding. I pretty much end my workday at 4 o'clock every day, just like I did when I was in the building. And so I've been trying to ride after work, and I think I'm going to switch it up since we're not going to go back for a while, and I've got a little bit more schedule flexibility. I'm going to start riding in the mornings again, which is really what works best for me and what I enjoy the most, but I don't enjoy being cold, so I'm trying to kind of, like I rode this morning about 10:30, and it was really nice.
What was the temperature like this morning?
I think I was a little overdressed, so it was probably between 55 and 60.
Oh, wow. Which, that early?
Yeah. Which really surprised me. And it was funny because I've been walking to work in the afternoons to do some work in my office. And a lot of times it feels just slightly chillier at 4 o'clock than it did at 10:30 this morning. So I don't know if it's just the angle of the sun or if I was riding uphill or what the deal was, but it was pretty nice.
Cool. Where have you been riding?
Pretty much everywhere. I live right in the middle of town. So I kind of just head north to the Schultz Pass area a lot, but there are way too many people in the woods over there right now.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. That's what's funny. I've been kind of complaining about who are all these people in the woods, because yeah, that's where I'm always very socially distant. I don't want to see people when I'm out.
Yeah.
So I've seen lots more hikers, lots more bikers. Yesterday I went over and kind of rode Fisher Point area on the south side, and I ran into way more people over there than usual.
Yeah.
So I haven't really been out to, I've heard it's a little muddy out at Rogers Lake, so I haven't been out there. Haven't been to Campbell Mesa at all. So mostly, and I ride up on Mars Hill Observatory Mesa. I ride up there quite a bit too. So.
Cool. Yeah, I was at, I did Campbell Mesa yesterday, and it was, didn't see too many people.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, but the trails, I mean, the trails were great. I mean, they're
good,
completely dry.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was a good ride. Did, I don't know, like 18 miles or something like that.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, I use Campbell Mesa as my, my zone two training.
Yeah.
Venue.
Yep.
Just kind of,
yeah, that, and I don't know if you ride much, kind of in that same area, but like the Loop Trail and the Arizona Trail on the Walnut Canyon Rim.
Yeah. Done that once.
That's also some, especially the Loop is pretty good zone two training, just because it's kind of more rolling and it's not super technical. So for me, I mean, I used to like to go there and just kind of pedal hard for, you know, 45 minutes to an hour or something. And it's pretty steady. It's not like you're coasting downhill for 25 minutes or anything.
Yeah. It's a good workout. You just kind of find that zone and just kind of like stick to it.
Yeah.
Campbell Mesa is great for that type of thing.
Yep.
So a lot of, I guess, because of all like the COVID stuff, I guess a lot of the races are going to be postponed.
Oh my gosh, the calendar's a disaster.
What is that? What's that looking like?
Well, so I don't know why I still do this, because I don't race and I don't have a race team anymore, but I don't know why. So I keep an updated racing calendar still. and yeah, I mean, everything, pretty much, I checked again all the kind of the, and I usually do kind of more regional Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado races. And pretty much everything, a lot of people have been able to move their dates, which is really nice. Because, you know, a lot of the people like Seth from Zio Rides, you know, he's running his own small business with that. And it's really hard to just up and cancel something.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Todd at Epic Rides had to just totally cancel the whiskey.
Oh, wow.
And Prescott. So yeah. That one, what's happening now is if you don't push your race to the fall and grab an open date, there's not going to be an open date. So there's already some redundancy on races in the fall. And especially with the high school races too. So fall's been jam packed for a while, and now it's even more packed. So anybody who can is moving stuff. MBAA, they just pulled the plug completely and just canceled the rest of their season for spring. Trying to think of what other big ones. I don't know what Epic Rides is going to do for, I think the Grand Junction race is towards the end of May. And so like USA Cycling has asked that all promoters not hold any races through the end of May. Whiskey, of course, I mean, Epic Rides is not USA Cycling certified or sanctioned, but so I don't know. I mean, you know, everybody's chomping at the bit to get back out there, but it looks like it's going to be a while.
Yeah. Even the tour has been, back. I mean, a lot of the really big races have been pushed back, and the UCI cross country stuff, I mean, forget about it. That's
they
pulled the plug on pretty much.
I don't think anybody really wants to travel or risk those kinds of crowds or any of that kind of stuff. And you know, I mean, the Olympics pulled the plug already, you know, 3 weeks ago or something. So,
yeah.
So something that big, I think kind of sets the stage for all sporting events to just kind of be, it just may be a year that we don't have some of that stuff.
Yeah. 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 The whiskey's a big one. I did that one year before last, I think. And
yeah, remember we all camped together.
Oh, that's right. Oh yeah. Yeah. But that time Chrissy didn't pee in the tent.
No, that's right. There were no disasters in the
Yeah, there were no disasters in that one. But that's a huge event. And it's sad. I mean, it goes without saying that you understand why they did it, but it's still kind of like, oh man.
Yep.
Kind of a thing. I had a project that I've been eyeballing for years that I had to pull the plug on, and it was just heartbreaking.
What was that?
It was a ski mountaineering trip.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was, I was working on actually Canyon. I was working on them sponsoring the trip and, pulling permits for filming and it was like a big, big production kind of thing. I had to pull the plug on it.
Shoot.
And the project was to, number one, climb Mount Sneffels in the San Juan, just outside of UA, and then just spend the weekend skiing the entire Yankee Boy Basin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Pretty much kind of like filming the whole thing and kind of make it into like a Canyon Cooler commercial type of thing.
Dang.
Not going to happen this year.
No, it's kind of frustrating. I was in Denver a couple weeks ago for spring break. It's actually kind of funny. when I came through the Eisenhower heading into Denver, I called my mom and I said, this is really weird. There's no ski traffic. Like, I had calculated my timing and I was like, oh crap, I'm going to hit all the skiers heading home on a Saturday afternoon. And it was really kind of eerie. And then when I got to my mom's, I realized they'd closed the ski areas that day.
Yeah.
So then I was like, my mom's like, well, you can still go up in the mountains. You can still backcountry ski and this and that. And I was like, yeah, I kind of feel like maybe we should kind of take it easy. And then, that was kind of the week that all hell was really starting to break loose on the closures and stuff like that. And like Crested Butte was just kind of on a full shutdown. They're like, that's it. We're closed. Town is closed for business. And my mom kept saying, I just don't understand why you can't go in the backcountry. I don't understand why you can't go and, do these things that you want to do by yourself. And I said, well, the biggest problem is that you can't risk needing, services, an airlift or hospital care or an ambulance or anything else. You can't do that to a small town when they're already suffering. So that's where, and even like on my way home at the end of that week, I ended up not going the northern route anyway for some reason, but like, for instance, Moab had pretty much closed down as well.
Yeah, I heard about that.
They don't want their services
away.
Yeah, they literally, normally I go that way, come and go through Moab to get to Denver now. And it's just kind of like, wow, that's really pretty trippy because, a lot of us are very self-sufficient. You go to a place like Moab and you might pick up some groceries or grab a beer or something else, but you head out a ways and camp or ski or hike or bike or do whatever. And you think, I'm not going to compromise anybody. Like, I want to do that stuff alone or with a small group, or whatever. But those towns literally have, like Telluride, all of those towns have said, please just don't come here.
Yeah.
Like if you get hurt or anything else. So, even when I ride here, I'm kind of careful. It's like, okay, I don't want to end up at the hospital right now. So.
Yeah. I've kind of been sticking to like the easier trails, like Campbell Mesa, the fire roads, just, kind of around my house and that sort of thing.
I haven't even been going to Sedona. I was thinking about it this weekend, but I'm like, there's just not really any reason to. It's okay. I don't need to.
Yeah. I mean, as long as I mostly do it for the fitness aspect of it. And fun. It's fun to like, rip down Schultz Creek or something like that. And get that nice, fun downhill thing. But I mean, for the most part, I do it to, just stay fit and healthy and be able to eat whatever I want and that sort of thing. but as long as I could still do that, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. The search and rescue thing, that was the main reason why I pulled the plug on my
project. Yeah, for sure.
It was like, it's going to be four of us, we're going to be in the mountains, away, you know, not very easily accessible.
Right.
You know, it's only a Jeep trail into where we're going. And if something happened, it's like, no,
yeah,
you know, it's just, it's too,
yeah, weird. I mean, I feel that way about backcountry experiences kind of in general. I remember years and years ago when we first started really skiing in the backcountry in Colorado, and, you know, people ski out of bounds or, you know, somehow get hurt or lost or messed up somehow. And, you know, it's always kind of like, man, you got to know what you're doing back there. But today, you know, in this time of COVID and everything, it's like, you really can't put that kind of strain on a local community search and rescue or their, yeah, or their care or whatever. So, yeah, I think it's just kind of wise to, I just always figure the mountains are still going to be there. You know, we just need to give it a rest.
Yeah. Thankfully though, I did get my AVI certification before
oh, nice, this good happened.
Yeah. So that's good. Did that in the first week of February.
That's cool. Did you do that in the San Juans?
Yeah. Yeah. I did it, Red Mountain Pass, between Silverton and Ouray.
Yep.
Been there a couple times now. It's great backcountry area. Yeah. Even when there's high AVI risk, there's still like really fun, low angle stuff that you could stick to. That's, you know, pretty,
yeah, that's what I was going to say. If you know what to avoid.
Yeah.
I always think it's kind of foolish to get caught in an avalanche.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause it, I mean, you don't even have to be certified to, I mean, if you just do enough research, you can pretty much know what to avoid, but again, more people in the backcountry every year and more people get in trouble. So,
yeah. So how do you think this is going to affect like the Scholastic stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Actually, are you still doing the Flag Youth Cycling stuff?
I'm not. I filed the paperwork to pull the plug on that. So,
oh, really?
Mostly just because I ran out of steam and I needed to work full time making money. So it was a year ago at the end of the last NBAA season with the kids, I pretty much decided that I just couldn't manage that in a full-time job basis. So, kind of thought about it over the summer, and the further I got away from running it, the more I realized I felt pretty good about not doing it. I mean, I'm sad because I really liked the idea and I think it's a great idea, but I just had to kind of recognize that at my age and with everything else going on, you know, if I could have just, I probably went about doing it wrong. Like if I could have gotten the funding and nonprofit status and if I'd have done it all right, you know, my hope would have been to have been paying myself like I'm getting paid a basis to be doing that, but it just never panned out that way. So, and I think the other thing, you know, working at a school, I'm actually the registrar now, so I don't have as much contact with the kids, but literally until a week before we closed because of COVID-19, I was the curriculum coordinator. So I was subbing a lot. I was doing all of our testing for K-12. So, you know, I'm hanging out with kids all day and I kind of realized I really like being around kids and I was getting my kid fixed that way. So I think just, you know, kind of physically, at my age, I just ran out of steam. I just couldn't do it.
So, yeah.
So the good news is I still have 850 kids at school every day, except right now. And I'm really sad that I won't even see these kids before summer. So it's kind of sad to think that everybody went home and on the last day before spring break and that's it. You know, it's usually pretty exciting to end the year with that many kids, but we won't get to this year. So people have asked me if I'll go back to maybe coaching the interscholastic stuff, but honestly, that wasn't a great fit for me either, just kind of structurally and kind of the administration of the program in Arizona wasn't really my cup of tea. So,
how so?
It's a little sexist. It's very, I don't really know how to say this. I think it's just, it's typical, but it's a lot of rich white kids and white men. And I mean, that's fine. There's a lot of those people out there, but you know, my passion with kids on bikes has always kind of been not necessarily working with the kids who can afford a $10,000 S-Works, but more working with the kids who need to go for a bike ride and, you know, need that kind of structure and that kind of support and that kind of team thing and all of that. So I kind of had to realize that, you know, my passion wasn't going to a bike race with a bunch of rich white kids. And I mean, that's, you know, that's the population of the state. It's just sort of the reality of it. And so it kind of lost its luster after a few years of working really hard and, you know, kind of realizing that, you know, even just girls were on the margin and Native American kids and Hispanic kids and Black kids, they're all, you know, you don't go to a bike race and see those kids, no matter how hard and people are trying. There are a lot of people doing good work, but it made me realize that it just wasn't really where my passion was at that time. So.
Yeah.
So I've been kind of doing as much as I can to help a friend of mine. I helped a couple of different coaches on the reservations get some stuff going on a couple of years ago. So there are quite a few programs now on the Navajo reservation. And I think there's a Hopi team as well. So wow. I'm trying to do a little bit more work to help my friend. She's got a Brownie troop out there and she's got a couple of composite teams that have raced in the Arizona Interscholastic League. So kind of just doing some, you know, a little bit of volunteering with her to get that going on. She runs a really cool tour in the summer that I've never had the time to do. But it's a tour on the Navajo Res, and it's a lot of kids. And I mean, I've been donating a ton of stuff to her programs and just doing anything I can to help those folks out. You know, that's where the need is. Those kids aren't on S-Works bikes.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you give them a pair of sunglasses and, you know, they don't have anything. They don't even have bikes or gloves or backpacks or anything. So I've just been funneling all of my stuff to them now because they need it.
What do you think the biggest, I guess, aside from the actual equipment, is, you know, the biggest barrier for folks like that to get into the sport? Is it awareness? Is it, you know, that
it's
sort of
thing? It's kind of all of that. I mean, you know, especially, I think culturally and especially being in a very rural situation on the reservation, it's just not a, it's not a part of anybody's family life. You know, I think, you know, running is popular. Basketball is popular when you think about sports for kids. But like one of the biggest things that I talked to Claudia and there's another fellow out in Gallup who's running some programs is just kind of the rural nature of it. So kids are just spread out far and wide. And, you know, really one of the joys of youth cycling is the kids being together.
Yeah.
So like you can't, I always tell my kids when I was coaching, go ride. You know, you don't need to ride just because we don't have practice doesn't mean you can't go ride your bike. Kids won't go ride bikes alone. They want to ride with their friends.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you live in a little community and you're 50 miles from your friends, what are you going to do? And, you know, there's some people out there doing some development on trails and tour companies and all. There's a lot of cool stuff going on, but you know, it would definitely be a cultural shift. Like those kids just don't grow up riding bikes. They live on dirt roads that are miles from anywhere. So, you know, I think there's definitely interest in it, but you know, they're just, everything's a barrier. They don't have money for bikes. They don't have places to ride bikes. They're not going to ride to school because God knows where school is.
Yeah.
So, you know, everything's just so spread out. So, you know, I think it's really cool that there are a lot of people out there doing some cool stuff, but it takes a while to kind of shift that paradigm of being able to ride mountain bikes.
Yeah. Yeah. And in places like Phoenix, for example, it's like, you don't have to go very far
right.
to do that. So is the barrier there, you know, combination of equipment and awareness, like, you know, this is like right in your backyard. You don't have to go very far.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun and you could do it with your friends. So yeah, that's interesting.
I'm hoping to do a little bit, you know, kind of get involved a little bit more, with some of that kind of stuff, just cause I think there's a lot of opportunity there to really help people find a healthier activity like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of these kids are probably the ones that need it the most, you know, to actually
be able to get, well, they're, you know,
get on a bike and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of times there's nothing easy about living on the Navajo reservation.
No, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They don't have water. They don't have electricity. I mean, they go without a lot of stuff that I think the rest of us just take very much for granted.
So. Yeah. Yeah. How crazy is it that, I mean, we live in, you know, 2020 times you know, you drive, you know, 50 miles outside of town and it's like, bam. Yep. It's like,
yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because I think a lot of people just don't really realize how different people's lives are that close to us. You know,
yeah.
So we're not talking about Mexico. We're not talking about another country, but we're talking about people in very impoverished conditions. And it's just, you know, what's going on. And I think a lot of people just whiz right by across the res and don't ever really consider it. So.
Yeah. It's great. Crazy times. So coming back to like the whole, I guess the scholastic aspect of it, I guess this whole COVID thing has just completely destroyed these kids' seasons.
I don't know, you know, in Arizona, the interscholastic series is in the fall. Normally the kids can start practice, I think around July 1st. And I honestly still get all of the emails, but I don't really follow along very carefully. You know, I think everybody's kind of fingers crossed that teams will be able to kick off their first practice on July 1 or whatever else. But I was talking to one of my coworkers whose daughter I coached, and, you know, this kid's trying to get ready for nationals, USAC nationals.
Oh, wow.
And then trying to get ready for her interscholastic season in the fall. And it's like, I guess she's, you know, she's been getting to ride a lot, and she's old enough now that she can ride by herself, and she's okay doing that. She's super motivated. So she's like, you know, she's out there trying to train. But her mom was asking me, you know, how do you coach somebody when you don't know what they're training for? And I'm like, yeah, training right now is really complicated, regardless of how old you are, because you don't necessarily know when your events are going to be. So, you know, I think especially for the kids, again, the interscholastic leagues are a really big social thing. And, you know, when you think of all the benefits that the kids get from that, and then to think that there's just like, you know, a lot of uncertainty around if they're going to even be able to do that. And, you know, what about the kids who would be having their senior season coming up? You know,
yeah.
Get to race their varsity or their senior season or whatever else. So, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I haven't really even been able to talk to any of the kids who I've coached to kind of see how they're feeling about it. I've talked to a few parents and just said, you know, keep them on the bike. Somehow they're going to have to get comfortable riding alone or feel safe about it or whatever else. So, but again, that's not why most of those kids ride bikes.
Yeah. So yeah. They do it for the camaraderie and
totally
the social aspect of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially among boys. Cause you know, they tend to like push each other.
Oh, totally.
You know, challenge each other. I saw it with Mateo this last season on the slopes where,
His ski racing.
Yeah, him and his buddy just kept like just pushing each other all season, and that was another thing that was heartbreaking. I mean, of course, understandable, but when they closed down, you know, snowboard, oh my God, Mateo's having like the most amazing ski season, and it has to come to an end like this. But yeah, I mean, I totally get the camaraderie thing and the social aspect. Of just going out and riding. How would you coach how would you coach kids now? Like what would be,
what would be
the advice, I guess, from a coaching aspect?
I still would say, you know, try and ride as much as possible, but this was kind of always the conundrum, especially for younger kids. I never trained. I mean, I had kids under 10 or 12 who would race, but I personally won't coach them on training plans.
Yeah.
Like, I just think that I don't think that's right. It's not that other people won't do it. And it's not that people won't put their own children on training plans, but I just don't think it's, I don't think it's appropriate. So, I mean, you know, really until kids are old enough to tell me that they want a training plan and they can explain to me how they're going to stick to a training plan. And that was generally like, I would say 14 and up. So for like the middle school kids who I had a lot of, it was always just kind of like, let's just go ride and have fun. Let's be social. Let's work on our skills. Let's work on our speed, but nothing super structured. Not like, you know, Monday you do this, Tuesday you do this. Last year we added in trainer nights in the winter time. And even that with some of the middle schoolers was a stretch because they just aren't into that level yet. And not that they aren't all, I mean, I had a 10-year-old last year who would do anything you told him to do, but I mean, you know, and some of those kids, I mean, it's kid by kid, you know, you have to be individual about it, but in general, you know, a lot of kids don't like trainer nights because it's not that fun. It's not fun like riding mountain bikes. So, you know, you kind of just have to judge it. But, like the kid whose mom I was talking to yesterday, she's super motivated and I don't even know if she's 14, but she's very talented and she's very motivated. So like for her right now, because I think Nationals has probably been canceled. I don't really know for sure, but it's kind of like, just keep riding.
Yeah.
You know, anticipate that you're going to have your fall interscholastic season, you know, the race dates, you know, we don't know if we're going to have them, but we know when the dates are. So I would say, you know, if she has a training plan, I don't personally coach her, but if, you know, stay on your training plan or get a training plan, if that's what you want, find somebody who can do that for you, coach. And then just stick to it. And, you know, right now there's plenty of good weather coming, lots of great trail riding. You may not be able to go out with your friends, but somehow find the motivation to get out there and do those hard workouts on your own. And I actually think that's good structure for kids to start getting into and kind of start understanding that, kind of moving it from being social to being like, if they really, really want to be competitive. So that's, I mean, you know, it's about that age that you start seeing kids kind of go from it being a social thing to like, yeah, I really want to do this. Maybe I want to be a pro someday, or I want to go to college on a scholarship. And you see other kids say, you know, I just want to finish my varsity season or my JV season or whatever and be done with it.
Yeah.
And all that's great. But yeah, I think it's kind of hard because even some of the kids who are motivated still want to go ride with their buds.
Yeah.
And right now they just really shouldn't be doing that. I honestly don't know what high school kids are doing because I don't think they're staying distant.
No.
But
at least not in my neighborhood.
I was just going to say, I've seen groups of them when I'm out riding, like at the parks and stuff. And I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, if I were 15, that's what I'd be doing. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. I've seen more people walking around my neighborhood than I've ever seen in or 8 years that we've been living here.
Adults, little kids. I've seen
people
everywhere,
yeah.
Which is good. I mean, and I've seen a lot of families together, which always makes me really happy. I've seen a lot more families like on the urban trails and stuff.
Yeah, that's good.
So it's like, I think a lot of families are kind of like, oh, our kids can't go play softball or soccer or whatever. So let's all go for a jog.
Yeah.
So I like to see that because it's a family thing. So that's good. But yeah, I think the hardest part for, like I was talking to a friend of mine in Phoenix who normally would be doing all kinds of races right now. And I asked her, you know, how are you staying on track? And she was like, yeah, she has a coach and she's an adult, but she still trains with her coach. And I forget what she's targeting, but she's just kind of staying on track for that. So, you know, kid or an adult has a reasonable plan, I would say just kind of stick to it.
Yeah.
And kind of maintain that. You know, I think the biggest thing, especially for kids or adults right now, is kind of, you know, pay attention to how you feel. Certainly in case you feel sick from COVID or something, but I mean, also pay attention to how you feel emotionally about everything and mentally, because I know for kids, it's a lot of uncertainty. It certainly is for adults. So, you know, if you don't feel like training, don't, you know, kind of give yourself that room to you know, fully embrace how you feel about everything right now.
Yeah. I think you're right about 14 does kind of sound about right, because I think at 14 when I was diving, that's around the age, that's around the age where it's like, okay, it's, I'm gonna get serious about this. You know, it's okay, I've already been to a couple regionals, I've been to a couple zone meets, I've had a small taste of what nationals could be like. But then when it got, when I got to 14, it's like, okay, now it's, I want a podium at nationals. That's,
you know,
and you, that's where you start to develop the, okay, this is, it's put in the work time, not just have fun with my friends time.
I think that's a, I mean, and it, again, it's kind of individual, but I think that's a good age for kids to start being able to make the decision that they want to do it for themselves. Like, they want it. It's not because their mom wants them to go there and do that, or it's not because all their friends are doing it, but because, like you said, they tasted the podium or or whatever it is, and they're like, damn, this is fun. Like, I want to, this is what I want to pursue. And I, you know, I somebody else was asking me recently about kids really specializing in one thing, and I'm so against that. I mean, I never wanted to even start my own bike team because I didn't want the kids to be racing in the spring in the NBAA series and in the fall in the Interscholastic series. But I realized that some kids just, they don't want to do anything else. Like, they don't want to have another sport. They don't want to play a team sport, or they don't want to play a musical instrument, or, and you know, I'm not their parent. I can't tell them what to do. So, I mean, I'd rather see kids do all kinds of things, but not every kid wants to do all kinds of things, and biking's great. So, but you know, I also think that younger than 14 or so, they're just kind of doing what they're told, or they're going where their mom takes them. So, you know, it's like, you know, and they haven't made that decision. They don't often understand the workload to really be a successful athlete, really in any sport. So, and I mean, I wouldn't want to train anybody much younger than that because it is a lot of workload, both physically and just time wise. So, you know, I always tell kids that there's so many other things that are more important than cycling when they're 12, and you know, whether it's family or school or church or whatever it is. So kind of trying to keep things well-rounded, but you know, kids get that taste. The kid who wants to go to nationals and everything else, you know, she's been on the top step, and that's, you know, she thinks about it all the time. You can tell. So,
well, especially now that you have, you know, some US representation in like the UCI stuff, like,
Yeah, totally.
You know, with Kate Courtney and that sort of thing. Like, I'm sure she sees that and it's like, oh no, I could do that.
Oh, totally. There's, I mean, it's kind of good for girls too, because, you know, somebody like Kate is such a good role model. I mean, guys and girls, you know, of all ages think she's the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she's done a lot for all kinds of competitive cycling, but, and I think, you know, she's a full-on product of NICA, the National Interscholastic League. So, you know, it's kind of, I think that's the one great thing about our Arizona League, the National Association, all of that, is that it's really upped the level of our talent. And, you know, it's like those kids are, you know, eighth and ninth graders today are faster than I was as, you know, a nationally ranked amateur. I certainly was never touching the professional level, but, you know, it's kind of like, God, these kids are just amazing, the boys and the girls. So, I mean, that kind of stuff is pretty cool to see, because, you know, we like to claim we invented mountain biking in the U.S. and then we've just had it handed to us ever since. So,
That is funny how that has worked, where, we invented the sport, but for some reason overseas, like, they perfected it.
But that's that whole thing that, you know, cycling has such a long tradition in Europe, especially. So, I mean, it's no great surprise that the Euros kind of stomped onto mountain biking, and, you know, drugs didn't hurt either, but yeah, it's just kind of amazing to think that no, we invented this. It was going to be like this. And then the Euros were like, no.
We're going to show you how it's done.
Yeah. This is how we mountain bike.
Yeah, exactly. And then we should just be like, well, why don't you come and do a little thing called the Leadville?
Yeah, so, right.
See how that works out for you.
I don't know.
The long marathon thing, I don't think is part of the Euro thing. They just have such They have such an ingrained culture with like Formula One and like track racing type thing.
Yeah.
It's no wonder why the UCI stuff kind of fits that same Formula One model, you know, World Cup and, you know, that's
well, I mean, it's all about the Benjamins. Nobody's going to watch a 4-hour marathon on TV or in the woods. So like, how do you sell advertising for that? So, you know, short track and cross country's just gotten shorter and shorter. It's practically like short track. But I mean, I honestly don't follow the UCI all that much. When I do watch it on Red Bull or anything, I'm like, what is this? Because it looks very different.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely very much more European. And yeah, it looks more like Formula One, you know, the sponsor banners everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And all of that kind of stuff. And I realized since I've kind of stepped away from being competitive personally, I kind of just stopped following all that stuff. And it's very different. But you can see it's a money thing. You know, it's like the Tour de France or any other big cycling event in Europe. It's all about selling it. So, you know, I think that's something the athletes kind of have to keep in mind, but I think it seems like it's a little different maybe for US athletes. I mean, I do kind of follow along a little bit with people like Payson McKelvin and some of the kind of more national level pros who don't do a lot. I mean, some of those guys will compete internationally, but you know, I still think that we don't have a national series that great anymore. And so I don't know. I kind of feel like we still have a different view of what mountain biking is than the Europeans.
Yeah.
But it's great that somebody like Kate can go over there and, you know, win a world championship basically.
Well, she's cleaning the floor with, with everybody else. Yeah. I mean, she's really, she has the stripes, right?
Yep.
I mean, she is part of that elite group of people that gets to wear the rainbow stripes when she's on her mountain bike. So that's
and there aren't many of those.
Yeah, exactly. But I like what they've done from like a spectator point of view in terms of those races. Cause I mean,
That's always been the conundrum in the U.S. with mountain biking, you know, from when it started in the 80s and even now. I mean, how do you get people to come out and wander around in the woods and watch a bike racer go by every once in a while?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, the other thing, you know, again, it's a European tradition. You know, you look at a road bike and how much has a road bike changed in 100 years? Not much. Europeans find something and they stick to it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what do we do in the U.S.? We had mountain biking and it was like cross country. And then we added in dual slalom. I mean, I think of all of the ways in which mountain biking has kind of shifted in the U.S. through USA Cycling or Norba or anything else. And we had dual slalom and I won a national championship in Super D. You know, I mean, that was around for a couple of years, but you know, all along in USA Cycling is just always a train wreck, but you know, they're always trying to figure out, well, how do we get spectators and how do we get sponsors and how do we get money? And I don't know. I mean, it's just one of those things where it's just not an American style of thing. Don't know. And, you know, I mean, cycling's just never, it just doesn't ever seem to catch on, whether it's road racing or mountain biking or BMX or, you know, it's always sort of fringy in the U.S. And we just don't have that long tradition of riding bikes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think having that final stop last year in West Virginia, I think that was a good move on their part.
Yeah.
In terms of, I saw it as UCI's way of exporting the European model into the US kind of thing. Especially now with, you know, you have such a high profile writer in like Kate Courtney that could really help sell it in the US.
But I still think that it's still one of those things that the average American, you know, we all know who Kate is, but
Yeah, we do.
You know, the average, I still think, you know, and it's a weird thing too, because, you know, a lot of people ride bikes, but they still aren't going to a bike race.
Yeah.
And then a lot of other people just don't ride bikes and they certainly aren't going to a bike race. So it's just one of those things where I don't know how much of that's ever really going to change a whole lot.
Yeah.
And I think Americans still would rather just sit at home and watch football. They don't, I mean, and, you know, I used to say this to parents even, you know, a lot of parents, if they aren't cyclists, they find going to a bike race kind of daunting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's dirty and it's outside and it's hot or cold or windy or dusty or, you know, it's not super fun. So I think it's, you know, it's, again, it's a hard sell to think that your average American is going to come out to some random place in the woods and hike up a mountainside and, you know, ring a cowbell for somebody they never heard of. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe the national, you know, the Interscholastic Association will change all that.
Yeah. And then you throw cyclocross into the mix. You want to talk about cold and dirty.
I was just saying, you talk about a really fringy aspect of our sport. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's like, we're going to take this cross country thing and we're going to make it harder.
Well, it's actually my favorite of all the disciplines I've raced. It's absolutely my favorite.
Oh man. That's just, yeah. I don't know if I could do that. That seems like for as,
when I,
short,
when I think
as
about,
short as it may be,
oh, it's suffering the best.
Is too much.
No, see, I have a really short attention span and it seems to get shorter the older I get. So to me, it's kind of like, I mean, if I can suffer like a dog for 30 minutes and then be done, it's like the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the great thing about cyclocross is you know exactly when it's going to end. Like if you're out on a cross country race, sure, it might be an hour and a half to 2 hours. you know the distance, you know, the lap structure or whatever. But I'm not kidding. I mean, I don't know what it is, but mentally I can totally suffer through 30 or 35 minutes of a cyclocross race because I know exactly when it's over.
Yeah.
And it's short. I mean, I don't want to suffer for 3 hours, but I can suffer like that for 35 minutes.
That was kind of, go ahead.
I was gonna say, it's sad. We just don't have a great, I mean, the Southwest is not known for great cyclocross. So I unfortunately don't get enough of it here.
Yeah, that was, I had delusions of grandeur of doing the doing the Bard Burner and try to qualify for Leadville. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna get the buckle and I'm gonna do this and I'm just gonna grind it out. And then I think like 2 weeks before the Barn Burner, no, maybe a little bit more, maybe it was like 3 weeks, 4 weeks or something like that, I did the ride to, you know, flag the Grand Canyon. I did that.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yep.
Which was 65 miles. And I learned something about myself. I learned that 50 miles, I think, is my,
yeah,
that's, yeah, that's my threshold. Anything beyond 50 miles, it's just not fun. It's not fun.
Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, I've always been much more of a, and I think a lot of it's attention span. I mean, I wouldn't even say it's physiological or talent or anything else. I don't like to do anything for very long. So, yeah, I mean, I can ride my bike all day, but, you know, I want to stop and look around. And,
yeah.
Like I like to bike pack and stuff like that, but I'm not making big days out of it. So yeah, I think, it takes a special person to like race all out for those long distances.
Yeah.
That's just mentally has never been my thing. So.
Would you ever consider doing the Arizona Trail, like the whole?
Yeah, I've thought about that. I've thought about that a lot.
You mentioned the bike packing, so I'm throwing it out there.
Yeah, my problem with a lot of those kinds of things, like the way I envision doing the Arizona Trail, is never as a race. Like I have no
right Like, no, just to do it, you know, just
yeah. People right. ask me all the time, you know, are you going to get back into racing? And the only thing I would do would be cyclocross. I have no interest in any other racing. And very, very little interest in cyclocross at this point, unless I were, you know, back east somewhere. But I really would like to do the Arizona Trail, but I absolutely refuse to carry my bike through the Grand Canyon.
So that part of it
is just like way too daunting. I hate carrying any type of a backpack, and I am not going to carry my bike. I just have like a total mental block about that. That part will never happen for me. And I actually really like hiking in the Grand Canyon, more or less. Like, I don't really like the standard Bright Angel, you know, all that kind of stuff so much. But, you know, and I think about the, you know, like doing the whole 750 or however many miles it is, it's like, well, that's just a stopper right there. That's a segment I'm not going to do.
Yeah.
Not with a bike.
It's called ride a bike, not hike a bike.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm trying to figure out now, what I'm kind of thinking about is just breaking it off into segments and kind of just starting to do them. And so I don't anticipate that I'll ever do it start to finish. And like I said, I can guarantee I won't do the whole thing on a bike. I actually keep thinking about hiking more, but then I go hiking and I realize I don't like it. my goal would be to bike pack as much of it as possible and then just like walk through the canyon and just hike that part. I don't think I'd ever have the time or the patience to just do it all at once. So I'd like to go down and maybe do the 300, the one that goes kind of from the border. Where does that end? It goes up over Mount Lemmon and ends like past Oracle. I forget where that one goes. But again, I don't want to race it. I've ridden quite a few of the segments down there. I'd like to see it all, but I don't see doing it all at once.
Yeah.
I always say I had a friend who really wanted to do the Great Divide race and, you know, from Banff to the border, the Mexico border.
Right.
And like, again, I think that would be a super awesome ride, but those racers, it's like they sleep on outhouse floors and they eat gas station burritos like for the 18 days that it takes them. Like, I would want to do it over the course of 4 months and eat and drink plenty of good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Like, hey, let's stop at this bar. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and of course you can't even do that on the Arizona Trail because it doesn't go through that many towns. So I don't know. I mean, the further I get from racing, the less that kind of stuff sounds at all fun to me. But, you know, seeing cool trail and seeing cool landscape is always good. And that's the other thing. I don't want to ride any of that stuff at night. Like, I want to see it all.
Yeah.
Those racers, they ride in the dark and everything. I'm not interested.
Oh yeah. They run into bears and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something about that just doesn't seem fun.
No, that kind of racing is a whole nother level. And I was reading about the Iditarod again the other day, and it's like, oh my God. Oh, those people. I mean, those are just a whole nother kind of person.
Yeah. 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 Not for me though.
No. I mean, you know, we have skis and we have bikes. I don't think you need to ride a bike in the snow.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what skis are for.
Yeah. That's why when I see those fat bikes, I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's kind of, people always, I always joke, my cousin lives in Denver and he rides a fat bike a lot. And he's been about the closest person to convincing me that it might be fun. But I still just kind of think, no, if it snows, I want to go skiing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, and I mean, I don't even ski that much anymore, but it still is more appealing to me than riding a bike in the snow.
Yeah.
Because I've never actually ridden a fat bike, so it's really hard for me to say that.
Yeah, I rode one once and I wasn't too thrilled about it. It just seemed kind of heavy and clunky and
I don't want anything that's fat.
Yeah, exactly. Like going from my cross country bike to that thing was like, ugh, I can't, I could barely pedal this thing.
Yeah. I think that is definitely a hold up for me. And then I always think, you know, I always tend to live upstairs, like in an upstairs apartment. And I'm like, how would I get that bike up there? For me, it's like all practical. I'm like, I don't want to ride in the snow and then have to drag a 50-pound bicycle upstairs with snow all over it.
Yeah, it's much easier to dust off snow off of skis than it is off of a bike. But yeah, no, I'm the same way. If there's snow on the ground, it's ski season.
Yeah.
You know, I put the bike away. It's, you know, it's time to get on the two sticks and go.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's something that I like like the change of nature that goes with it. Like you're kind of changing with the time and that sort of thing. So I feel like there's a psychological component.
Yeah. And I mean, it also goes back to that whole idea, like even with kids, like you don't need to ride a bike all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, go ski, go snowshoe, go play tennis. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of other things to do. And, I mean, to me, it seems like I miss the backcountry. I liked when I lived in Colorado, I did a lot of backcountry skiing, and I like that because it's quiet. It's not as equipment. I mean, there's equipment obviously with skis and poles and bindings and boots and Abbey gear and all that kind of stuff, but it's a little bit more simple and it's quiet.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still fitness. It's still fun downhill. But it just seems like it's a good opportunity to switch it up a little bit.
Yeah.
We don't have enough of it here, but
yeah, I feel more connected to the present moment when I'm backcountry skiing. Like you feel part of your surroundings more so than when you're on a bike. Because when you're on your bike, you're just kind of like zooming by, you know, kind of.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the reasons why I keep thinking I want to go hiking. because I realize, I mean, I see a lot of cool stuff on my bike, probably because I'm going so slow most of the time. But, you know, not downhill. And then I think, well, you know, I'd see a lot more if I were hiking, but then you don't cover as much ground. So that's always sort of my problem.
Yeah. You hit a downhill part and you're like, this would be a lot better on a bike.
And I'm as pokey as I am on a bike right now, I'm even pokier when I'm walking. I don't cover a lot of ground. So, I mean, I like to just go out and hang out. I don't think I'm much of a motivated hiker.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something about, you know, when mountain bike season comes to an end, I'm not as sad about it as when ski season comes to an end.
Yeah, that's totally true.
Like when ski season comes to an end, it's like, oh man, that was my last run.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have to think back. That's funny because I haven't skied a lot since I was pretty young, like high school and college age. But that's when, I mean, I wanted to be a professional skier, but there's not really any such thing. But it's just funny because, and I was riding a bike then, but there wasn't mountain biking in the early 80s really yet, not in Iowa or Colorado even. And I remember, like, you know, I'd spend my whole summer getting my stuff ready.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that I just pretty much ride bikes and ride them all year round, cause you can here, it's kind of like, I forget about that anticipation of like getting your gear all set up and
scraping the wax off the skis.
Yeah. Like making sure your down coat was ready. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny when you don't have that kind of fun stuff to look forward to. Cause all I ever do is ride a bike.
Yeah. How did you get into mountain biking? I mean,
you know, I worked at Gart Brothers Sporting Goods in Denver in 1984. And I was managing like the ski department, but we had a bike department too. I mean, Gart Brothers sold everything.
Yeah.
And I worked in one of our suburban stores. But I was downtown at the Sports Castle, which if you're familiar with Denver, that's a big part of ski history, is the big Sports Castle down on Broadway. And I was down there for a meeting one day, and one of the guys from the bike shop said, "Hey, you got to see this bike we got." And I'm like, "What is it?" And he had it up in the work stand. He was putting it together and it was really small.
It's called a Gary Fisher.
No, it was a Cannondale of all things.
Oh.
Yeah. But it was, you know, Cannondale used to make some really small frames, and I just kept looking at it, and I'm like, it looks like it would fit me. And I'm like, but what is it? And he's like, it's a mountain bike. And so that was the first mountain bike I ever saw, was in 1984 in Denver.
Oh, wow.
And then I moved back to Iowa City after that. And I think in 1985, I bought my first mountain bike. Cause they were kind of, mine was a Diamondback, but like Diamondback, Specialized, Cannondale, Schwinn, you know, there were some, all those bigger brands, Specialized, of course, yeah. They were all out there. But I'd had it in the back of my mind since I'd seen that bike. I'm like, I don't know what that was, but it sounded great, you know, and it looked like it would have fit me. It didn't even have wheels or anything on it. And I never saw it again after I saw it in the stand that day at the sports cast. So yeah, then I bought my first one in 1985, I think.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So when did the relationship with Giant kind of start to come into the picture?
You know, that was about, I think it was 10 or 11 years ago when I was living in Tucson. I was riding with a bunch of, we had what we called a nurse's ride. It was actually a bunch of nursing faculty who I worked with at the University of Arizona. And actually my one friend, Zoe Cohen, she's faculty at the College of Medicine. She's a physiologist. But she had a friend who was the account executive for Giant for the Southwest region. And so she was trying to start a team. Giant was doing a thing called Giant for Women. This was all before Liv.
Yeah.
So Cindy was the account executive, and she set up this team. And so there were, I think, four or five of us in Tucson. I was living in Tucson at the time. A couple of ladies out of Phoenix. And so we had a team. I think it was really only for 1 year. But Cindy hooked us up working with kind of all the different bike shops in Phoenix and Tucson and her region or whatever, hooked us up with some pretty nice bikes and kits and whatnot. And, that's the first time I had a relationship with Giant. And actually I was racing on the first Giant Anthem carbon frame.
Oh, wow.
And I love that bike. Yeah. That was a sweet bike. Unfortunately, it was basically loaned to me. I had to give it back, but, that was a nice bike, you know, and mountain bikes were, all 26 inch wheels then.
Yeah.
It was full suspension and it was super lightweight. And, you know, they made that bike for a year and then they had to rethink it for some reason. They went back to aluminum. Another couple of years before they came out with, you know, pretty much everything else in carbon.
Yeah.
But they didn't, Liv didn't exist yet. They were just kind of branching off into the Giant for Women and trying to do some more women specific designs. So that was pretty fun, but I kind of went from that team back to, did I go back to Absolute? Yeah, I went back to Absolute Bikes after that. And raced with the Flagstaff team for quite a while after that. And then it was only, I guess, 3 years ago, Liv, you know, the women's brand of Giant was full on women's brand, totally branded separately.
Yeah.
So they were looking for ambassadors, and that's how I went to work for that program a couple of years ago.
Are you still involved with that?
No, I didn't apply for the ambassadorship this year. I think just because, I don't know why, actually. I just kind of ran out of steam on that, too. I eliminated a lot of stuff in the last year of life. I still have two Liv mountain bikes and a Giant gravel bike. And kind of just didn't really want to do it again. I mean, yeah. I had a lot of good times. It really was a fun program because I got to go to a lot of different events, and Giant and Liv are very generous about their ambassador programs. So I had a lot of nice benefits from that. But I don't know. It just kind of seemed like I'd done it all.
Yeah.
I was ready to do something else or not do anything else is really what I was getting at.
Was it a big time commitment?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. They, one of the years they wanted us to do a lot of events, and then last year they didn't have us do as many events, but it kind of coordinated with the bike racing team, and I just was doing way too much stuff.
Yeah.
So kind of hosting those events for women just got to be a little bit more than I was really interested in. But like even this year, I still did some work for them. I went to the Mountain Bike Festival in Sedona, for example, which was sort of our last big thing. I talked to our demo driver the other day and found out she's laid off because, you know, nobody's doing events. So that Mountain Bike Festival was kind of the last event any of us have been to.
Yeah, I heard that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hang on one sec, Dan.
Yeah.
I'm just doing a podcast with my friend. Sorry, my boss just came in.
So fancy, your boss.
Well, technically I'm off the clock because it's 4 o'clock.
I came to get this.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Oh, good. Yeah, I sold a Giant this morning to a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think the gravel bike was the Giant.
He just said, so I bought the bike.
Nice.
And the whole point is that it'll fit in my car, it won't fit in his.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, well, I'll go to
the
car.
Okay, good.
And we're going to deliver the
signs.
I got 3 of them.
Oh, good. No, my director's husband texted me this morning, Dan, about buying a bike. And so I told him what to buy, and he called Bike Rev, and I guess he's buying it.
Nice. First bike day.
They owe me a lot of commission. I sold a lot of bikes for them.
I'll talk to Austin about that.
Yeah, you too. Okay. Yeah, we can do Zoom. Like, that's what Dan and I are doing. Right. Oh, so sorry, Dan.
Yeah, no worries. So what goes into being a Giant ambassador?
Ambassador.
Like, yeah. Like what do you have to, what's the expectation?
Giant? Well, in Giant, that was the other thing too. Like the first year I was a Live ambassador, I think there were like 150 women in the program all over the US. You had to apply. And yeah. It was one of those things I randomly applied for it and I totally forgot about it. And I've applied for other ambassadorships and never gotten anything.
Yeah.
So they offered me a, and I was like, oh my gosh, I totally forgot about that. So that first year we had to do, I think, 4 national events where they pick the dates and then you do something that day. And the cool thing is they put a ton of marketing into those dates.
Yeah.
And then we also had to do some just kind of more local events and some bike shop events. I mean, in a perfect world, I think Liv and Giant wanted the ambassadors to work very closely with their local shops. Which I was doing, and FBR, of course, was totally stoked about it, but I think I'm not very good at that kind of, like, those kind of event kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I got them all done, and I always had a lot of women turn out, and the women really, really enjoyed it, but I don't know, you know Jody Bartz, right?
Yeah.
She's the kind of person who should be doing that stuff, not me. So actually, when she was still here, she would help me with that kind of stuff. She's so much more outgoing and enthusiastic, where I'm just kind of like, I don't know, get on your bike and ride.
Yeah. So, yeah, she seems like the type of person that could be enthusiastic about a number 2 pencil.
Yeah, absolutely. and get you so stoked about it.
Yeah,
whereas, like, I mean, and I think what I realized too, like, because I was working with kids at the same time, is I was way more stoked to be working with kids.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's super hard. People in the industry have asked me for many, many years, you know, what's the answer to getting more women on bikes? And I kept saying, I don't know. Maybe I'm not the person for that. I don't really know. There's a million reasons why women don't want to ride bikes, or why they don't ride bikes for very long. And when I started working with kids, I'm like, well, number one, there's your answer to women on bikes, is get girls on bikes.
Yeah.
But even that is kind of hard. So I don't know. I mean, I think the industry keeps wanting more women on bikes, but it's just a hard sell.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would kind of go through stages where I'd be like, yeah, I'm really excited about this. And I'd be like, oh, just go ride your damn bike. I don't know. So, you know, I mean, the LIV program was mostly geared around those events. And then they did ask us to go to some more regional events. Like I went to, I helped our previous demo person with a huge women's event in Moab. I helped him with an event in Durango. We did the Sedona Mountain Bike Festival. We did the Rome Festival.
Oh, nice.
So, I mean, the cool thing is, you know, I love all the connections that LIV hooked me up with women. Like, you can go anywhere and find a LIV ambassador and go for a ride and have a good time.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, that kind of networking is, you know, I mean, everybody I know from the last 30 years is a biker. So, and, you know, I mean, I know people all over the world from that. So there's always that benefit. But it was, you know, that was part of the cool thing. And then, you know, we obviously got good deals on bikes and gear and all that kind of stuff. They kind of, it was a little bit frustrating. LIV and Giant, I think, especially in the U.S., have a little bit of a problem keeping their shit together that way. that's been my experience over and over again, is that, and I think the whole industry is like that, because it always comes from marketing funds.
Yeah.
And I'm probably preaching to the choir by telling you this, but you know, it sort of comes and goes. And, you know, this year we're going to focus on this, and then next year we're going to focus on something different. And so I think just structurally, it was a little bit frustrating sometimes. Like I was telling our current person, the one who just got laid off, the demo person, or I don't, what do they call them? They call them field reps, I guess. So she's this woman, Casey, was the one driving around in the van full of LIV bicycles and doing all these events. But I was telling her earlier in the year that, you know, what was frustrating to me was that I wanted all the gear. Like, I'm a great representative. I'll sport anything you want me to wear and whatever else. And I'm not kidding you. I'm not lying when I say my LIV bikes are the best bikes I've ever had. A lot of their clothing and gear is top notch. Like, I'm sporting some shoes right now. They're some of the best mountain bike shoes I've ever had.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, like, I'm happily wearing that stuff, and I'll pay for that stuff. Like, I don't want to pay the price for it, but no one ever does. So, you know, but the second year in the program, it was like impossible to get anything. And I don't know, you know, if it's sourcing from Asia. I don't know enough about supply chain. I don't have any idea, but I was like, you know, I want more cool jerseys. I want more cool shorts, gloves, helmets, whatever. And it was just really hard to get some of that stuff. So I think for me, that's always a hang up. It's like, and then like, I get that Bike Rev isn't going to sell a ton of LIV stuff because they don't think there's a market for it.
Right.
But that's the other problem. It's like, no lady is going to buy a jersey online without seeing it first. That's just not how women shop. So
I need to try it on.
Yeah, they got to try it on. So they're just, I mean, that there are all kinds of reasons why selling women specific stuff can be hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, and I mean, go ahead.
I would say it's certainly a great brand, and I'm not kidding when I say their products, both soft goods and bikes, all of that stuff is truly amazing stuff. And you know, the way they design it and develop it, it's a huge global company. Sometimes I think just the way it gets run in the U.S. is a little bit sketchy. It's just you know, tight budgets, and I think not a lot of planning goes into it.
Well, and also, I mean, the pace at which technology is constantly changing in the bike.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and just even the styles of bikes are changing every year. Like, okay, this year, I guess they're going more cross country this year, or this year they're going with a more trail vibe kind of thing. I mean,
I'm due for a new bike, and I can't find what I want. And I'm not even just talking about LIV and Giant. I'm talking about everybody's bikes. So,
I want the new generation of the bike that I have now.
Yeah.
But you can't find it.
You can't. No, and Austin at the shop asked me, I was bugging him a couple months ago, and he was like, well, what exactly are you looking for? So I described to him my perfect bike, and he was like, that's what you have. And I'm like, yeah, but it's like 3 years old. And, you know, the colors are a little outdated.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little banged up, you know, it's...
I mean, some paint scraped off, I don't know. So he's like, he just shakes his head and he's like, I don't know what to tell you. But I'm like, he's like, what do you want? I'm like, I want this bike, but I want it updated. And there isn't one because, and you know, this is not a big deal, but Liv introduced the bike of my dreams, the bike I have, but they put big wheels on it this year.
Yeah.
And the big wheels aren't the biggest holdup. They undersuspended it. They turned it into a full on cross country race bike, which is brilliant. I mean, it's a beautiful bike.
Yeah.
But that's not my style anymore. So I've ridden it and it was kind of underwhelming. I mean, if I were racing at McDowell every weekend, oh my God, it's like, but for up here and for the kind of the Sedona kind of stuff, it's, you know, I'd have to put a bigger fork on it. And so I just kind of, I was kind of bummed because I'm like, wow, my last year as an ambassador and I'm not getting a bike. Actually, I guess I got my gravel bike this last year, so it's all good.
Yeah, I always flirt with the idea of getting like an upgraded like trail bike kind of thing with, you know, 130 in the front or something like that. And then I'm like, I would never use that travel.
Oh, like, so not true.
For the type of riding that I do,
No.
You don't think so?
No. I you know, I always say, because I, you know, like my, when I was racing cross country, I was on an S-Works, or Epic, I guess. It wasn't S-Works. But, you know, a specialized cross country rig. What was it, 100 mil in the front, maybe 90 in the back. And I'm like, oh, no, that's all I'll ever need. I'm small. I don't jump off of stuff. And then I switched to the Liv, which was, my Liv is 130, 120. And I use every bit of that. So, and on my hardtail is a straight up cross country hardtail. It weighs like 18 pounds. Wow. It's got 100 mil RockShox on the front. And where was I yesterday? Oh, I was riding Fisher Point area yesterday on it, and I top it out every time I ride.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd like a little bit more fork on that hardtail. I mean, I like it at 18 or 20 pounds, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind
of...
I'm in the same kind of dilemma where it's like, I want to get a new bike, but I can't find what I want.
Exactly what you're looking for. Yeah. What was the review I just read? Oh, the Kona Heihei looks really nice. So they, because they did, and actually Artec Durham just got one, but they did kind of like, it's a cross-country bike, but it's just a little bit slacker geometry. And then I think it's 120, 120 or 120, 130, 120. I don't remember, but it's like not up to 140.
Yeah.
So it's somewhere, you know, on the lesser end of the suspension. But still a little bit more than 100, like 100 is just underkill. It's just not enough. So, but the reviewer was complaining that it's, you know, he said something about, you know, we all want that bike that has enough suspension, but it still pedals uphill and it doesn't weigh 35 pounds and this and that.
Yeah.
And I always think, yeah, that's totally true.
The one quiver bike.
Yeah. And I don't know why no one's really doing that. Like, I feel like that Liv Peak that I have is just spot on for that. And it is really the do everything bike, but I don't know. The industry probably figures, well, if we can get you to buy a cross country bike and get you to buy an all mountain bike.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So I don't know.
Why have one when you could have two for twice the price?
Yeah. And American consumers are pretty good about saying, yeah, I guess I do need three or four bikes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like this friend of mine who I sold the bike to this morning, he was like, whoa, what are all these different types of bikes for? Like, he doesn't know anything about bikes. He thought he needed a, you know, he's looking for a 10 speed basically.
And you're like, you're adorable.
Yeah. So I was trying to explain it all to him and he's like, whoa, you know, and I'm like, well, the industry thinks, you know, I mean, I think gravel bikes are the most hilarious invention ever, but I have one. I mean, there's certainly a purpose for them. Actually, that's what I sold Trevor this morning, was a gravel bike.
Yeah.
Because it'll do a little bit of everything.
The road bike on steroids.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, nobody wants to ride on those little skinny tires.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm with you on the 1 mil travel, 100 mil travel. I feel it's like I need a little bit, just, yeah. Just not, I feel like if 110, 120, I feel would be kind of like that sweet spot for me.
Yeah, and I think that's where you can kind of find that sweet spot of just enough suspension, but not an overly heavy,
yeah,
you know, bomber style of bike, something that you can still pedal uphill, and everything's getting really slack in the geometry. I haven't really wrapped my head around what that means. I mean, other than they descend really nicely, but then they can kind of be tanks on the climb. So,
yeah, not as nimble on tight turns and
right. That
sort of thing. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, definitely the nimble part. You're going to lose a lot on that.
Yeah. And that's still my, you know, I think back to when I started looking for something after my last Epic. And what I remember saying to Austin, I want something that's, you know, kind of that whippy, lightweight feel.
Yeah.
You know, and fast. And I think the Peak kind of really fills that. I mean, it's not quite as fast, but it's pretty darn light and it definitely feels whippy. And it's like, I mean, I haven't ridden a ton of other bikes, but I've ridden some and I'm just like, no. So, I mean, I think if you've ever raced cross country or marathon, you kind of get it in your head that you want something pretty light.
Yeah.
And something that pedals pretty good, because that's what we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, the industry is heavy on the technology from the suspension and everything. And that makes things kind of heavy and downhilly. And that's just not what I want.
Yeah, no, tell me about it. I'm dying to get a new fork on my bike.
Yeah.
Cause I'm giving up on the getting a new bike. So I'm gonna pimp out what I have.
I don't know. If I were you, I'd be looking at that hey. like I haven't done it yet, but I have a big spreadsheet full of geometry numbers from every bike I've ever had.
Oh, you're one of those.
Yeah, well, because as a woman 5'4" tall, I can't ever walk into a bike shop and stand over a bike.
Yeah.
So I have to compare all the geometry. And it's getting really trippy because the head tube and seat tube angles are changing so much that I can't mentally understand how that's going to ride differently. So, I mean, I can look at things like reach and standover height, which again, as a short person, are pretty important in the frame size, but I still don't, you know, it's kind of like, oh man, now all the angles have changed and all this other stuff has changed. So it's kind of hard to make all these comparisons, but I want to look at that. Hey, like if it's small enough to fit me, I'd buy that. I mean, that's, especially since there, you know, I mean, I try and keep my business to one or two shops. One here and one in Phoenix.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I mean, I want to buy my bike from Bike Rev every chance I can get, but you know, they don't carry every brand in the world.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I looked around at the festival in Sedona and what did I ride there? I rode an Ibis and was kind of like, meh. I mean, I guess because it's an Ibis, I thought it was just going to be loud. And I've got my eye, I've been kind of looking at a stump jumper, a Specialized, but I'm not totally sold on that. I haven't had a chance to ride it. So I don't know. But seriously, I think, how old is your Giant?
It's a 2015, yeah.
Yeah, see, you need new geometry. Yeah.
But I love my bike. I love the way it rides.
Yeah, but I mean, when you start talking about upgrades like a fork.
Yeah, that's where I kind of get stuck.
That's where you need. Yeah.
Because it's like the only other fork I could get is probably just another 100 millimeter. Because if I go bigger, it's not going to work with, you know, the head tube geometry and all that stuff.
That's what I was going to say. It'll change up the geometry a little bit. Yeah. Like that was the thing when we were talking about the Peak this year with the bigger wheels and the too little suspension. Austin kept saying, we can just throw a bigger fork on there. And I'm like, yeah, but it wasn't designed for that.
Right, exactly.
So,
yeah.
I mean, the other thing you could be looking at are the new Giants, because there's nothing wrong with those.
No, I know. And I like what they've done. I like the upgrades they've done to the Anthem.
That's what, well, isn't there a... I have to, what's the, not the Anthem, that's kind of the cross country bike, but what's the, I thought there was kind of a short travel, what's the other, what's the next
Trance.
One? The Trance, yeah. Isn't there a short travel Trance?
I don't know.
Normally I think a Trance is probably like 150, 160, 150 or something, yeah. But I thought there was a Trance that was like 130, 120.
Game changer.
I know. So, well, you know what though? Maybe that's not for 2020. Maybe it was the 2019s. Because Austin and I were looking at that a little bit.
Yeah.
And see, you are fine on 29-inch wheels. I mean, it took me forever to switch from 26 to 27.5. And now I'm like, but I love 27.5.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine going back to 26.
I could, but I'm five, like I was saying, 5'4". Like yeah. if I were your size, I'd be perfectly happy on 29s.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be a no contest, but yeah. So, I mean, I'm still kind of fighting against 29s, but the industry's really pretty much gone back to it.
Yeah.
27.5s were around for a minute and they're kind of going away.
Well, hell, you're starting to see 29s on downhill events.
I know.
And you're like, wow, really?
Yeah, that was sort of my last holdout, even though I'm not much of a gravity person. I would always say, well, you never see downhillers on 29-inch wheels. Yeah.
Yeah, you do. You do now.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken me 10 years, but yeah. I'm gonna get there.
And riding clipless, which is...
like, yeah, that's... Well, the jury's still out on that. That's still personal preference, I
think. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm kind of in a holding pattern right now. I did look at the new Anthems, mostly because, well, the other thing is I want a new drivetrain.
Yeah.
I'm tired of my SLX 2x.
Yeah. So then if you're looking at all of those things, Dan, a new bike is cheaper than all of the stuff you're going to put on that old.
Yeah. I was looking at that today and I'm like, okay, I could do the lesser grade SRAM Eagle GX, and it's, you know, you could do the whole drivetrain for like $600. But if I want to go big. Okay. I want the XX1. Yep. I want the rainbow cassette just because it looks cool.
The good thing about Giant's price points are still so much better than anybody else's.
Yeah.
I mean, and you get a lot of bike for the money.
Yeah.
Because they're not a boutique brand. And I mean, I know a lot of people are kind of like, oh yeah, just another big brand. And they always kind of have that like slightly, I mean, in my mind, I used to think they were sort of the Kmart and Specialized was sort of the Target. Well, neither one of them's that, but you know, I mean, and Specialized certainly isn't that today because now they're way more expensive, but you know, Giant always kind of seemed a little lower end to me than Specialized when I raced for Specialized. But when I look at it now, it's kind of like, you know, I mean, they build frames for Scott, they build frames for Track, they build frames for all kinds of people.
And yeah.
I mean, their carbon fiber is amazing and everything is well designed. And then, you know, the componentry, you can get that on anything. So, you know, pick what you want on that, but you're still going to get a really good price on a bike just because they buy so much SRAM. They buy so much Shimano. They buy so much, you know, they make their own wheels out of DT wheels or whatever. So, you know, I still think when I look at the retail price points on Livs and Giants, I'm like, shit, that's a lot of bike for $5,000.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. So, the Trance or the Anthem that I was looking at, was just about that price point. It was like $5,000.
Yeah, I mean, and you get a really nice bike for that, like a decent fork. Good. I'm not a huge SRAM fan, but most people like their stuff pretty well. And you don't have to go all in on the Eagle stuff, the XX1. I think whatever the next one down from that is pretty good.
Yeah, that's the one that I was pricing out and came to the realization where I was like, okay, I want a fork. I want the XO1. I want new wheels.
Yeah, then you're just, I mean,
just buy another bike.
Yeah, absolutely. I would.
Yeah.
And I always get to that point where, like, everything really goes bad all at once. Like, all of a sudden, you're going to need a fork and wheels and, let's face it, a drivetrain.
Yeah.
That's a bike. there's like, no reason to keep the old thing around after that because it's never going to ride. I mean, God, there's just nothing better than riding a brand new bike. and seriously, like, it always takes me a while, obviously, to come up to speed with bigger wheels or new suspension or different geometry. But, you know, there's a reason why it's out there, I guess, is what I always figure. Somebody's deciding some of this stuff is worthwhile. And I'll never agree with bigger wheels necessarily as a smaller person, but pretty much everything else, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, they, you know, that's a well thought out fork or a well thought out derailleur or whatever it is. So most of that stuff does get better for all the right reasons.
Yeah. Although I haven't quite committed to the dropper post yet.
Oh,
I'm not there. Just like you're not there with big wheels, I'm not there with the dropper post.
Nope. That's, that's probably one of the things that surprises my friends the most is how quickly I converted to droppers. I want one on the gravel bike. I kid you not. I'm going to get one. The only thing is I was thinking about putting a kind of a more of a suspension post on the gravel bike, but no, that's, when I got my Live hardtail, of course it didn't come with one. And the first thing I said was, don't even build it without the dropper post on there. And the guys were like, seriously? And I'm like, I'm not even kidding. So they didn't even give it to me until they put the dropper on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a total game changer. And I have said to so many parents, if you do one thing when you buy that kid a bike, put a dropper post on it. Because it's really a game changer for kids. Teaches them how to corner and handle their bike a whole lot better, faster. Okay. Cornering is the biggest thing that I think people don't think about with droppers.
Yeah.
But I can teach a kid to corner so much better with a dropper post.
Really?
Yep.
Huh.
That to me is the biggest game changer about a dropper. Of course I use it for descending, but it changed my cornering so much that I can't even believe it.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right.
And most people really struggle to kind of figure out how to corner well.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, what I always tell the kids, if you think about it, like I have the kids pretty much if they're not pedaling, I always say, drop the post and sit.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, that feels weird or that's stupid. Why are we doing that? But if you corner that way, if you think about where your center of gravity goes when you're sitting on a dropped saddle.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Exactly where you want it.
Yeah.
It's down like right in between the wheels where it needs to be. Your butt's not way back. I mean, as soon as, you know, we used to shift our butt way off the saddle.
Yeah.
But then it's like super high, right? Like, and you're unweighting the front wheel by doing that. So you have all your weight over the back wheel, which immediately unweights the front wheel. And it's just high center of gravity, which for cornering, you're all over the place.
Yeah.
So if you can kind of like drop yourself down into the bike, it's amazing how you can corner so much faster, better, more efficiently.
Yeah.
And then
I'll think about it.
Yeah, seriously, that is one of those things where, and I think Austin's probably still just like, wow, I can't believe we got Sue on a dropper. But like when I got the Peak, when I got the first Live, the full suspension, it came with the dropper. And Austin was so cute because I didn't have a dropper on my Epic. And he was in like, I still had pretty narrow bars and this and that. And he was like, do you want us to set this up the same way? And I'm like, no, I want it stock. I want to just give it all a try because it's all different. And it took, I mean, there's definitely a learning curve to a dropper post, but I always think if you stay with it, And so like I kept the bars wide and I was like, no, I'm going to have you cut off a little bit. And they're like, but it's carbon bar. And I'm like, no, I know. And sure enough, it's too narrow. Because then on my hardtail, I left the bar stock width. And it's not super wide because it's women specific. But it's a little bit wider than on my full suspension. And I notice it. I'm just like, no, I can have this be a little wider. So, you know, I told Austin, I'm like, I try to remain committed to trying new stuff. And it's not easy for me. But especially as a brand representative, it's important.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think when I think about it, I'm like, I don't think anybody ever expected me to go for the dropper post. But there you go.
Yeah, I think that's what they're thinking about me. They're like, he's never going to. He's never going to.
Don't be the curmudgeon.
Yeah.
Well, and Austin taught me something a few years ago, and he laughs because I still say it back to him. But, you know, everybody's an expert, even though they've never tried it.
Yeah.
And so I try and keep that in mind. I'm like, how did such a young guy give me such a good piece of advice? But he's right. You know, it's like, if you can, try it.
Yeah.
And see. Like, and droppers aren't that expensive. They're not that heavy. I mean, I definitely, even if I were racing cross country, I think I'd still want one.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. All right. Okay.
It took a while to kind of, like, it actually didn't take that long to get used to. Like, if you ride enough, when I got that peak, I was probably riding it every day and I made a few mistakes. And of course, I also went from, I think I went from a 2x to a 1x with a dropper. So okay. I kept dropping the post when I would try and shift. That was like the worst thing that happened. But, you know, once you get used to kind of where you need it and it, you know, it goes right down and comes right back up and it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting rid of the 2x is definitely top of my list.
Yeah. That was not a stretch. People still are like, oh, do you need to really, is that really a good idea? And I'm like, oh, that's a no brainer.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that as a no brainer. And I hear people say like, oh no, I prefer my 2x. It's like, you're crazy.
No. You don't know. No, that's only because you don't have a 1x that you like your 2x.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's still a little bit of, I'm trying to think. I don't have a 12 speed setup. So I think I have two 11 speed setups. And it's a little sketchy on either end. Like if you think about the chain tension and wear. But I have one SRAM setup and one Shimano setup. And honestly, both of them work just fine.
Yeah.
So that I don't even think about that anymore.
Yeah. Who was it that was telling me at Bike Rev? Who was it? Jeffrey?
Yeah.
I think it was Jeffrey. He was telling me that when it comes to the drivetrain, at least the trigger.
Yeah.
SRAM is the way to go. Because he feels that Shimano just over-engineered the trigger. Hmm. So from like a maintenance perspective, it's a pain in the ass.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, talk to the mechanics about that kind of stuff, I'm sure.
Because I remember last year I took my bike in there because my trigger just completely wore out. I needed a new trigger. And he was like, yeah, this is why I don't like dealing with Shimano drivetrain.
Yeah.
Because these triggers... Like he tried to like fix it and like rebuild it and that kind of thing. He's like, dude, just buy another trigger. You know,
yeah.
If it was SRAM, I'd be able to kind of like rebuild it for you. But
yeah, I think I always feel like SRAM's a little bit more kind of mechanical. I mean, obviously they're both mechanical, but, but like, I don't like the way my SRAM setup feels. But it's like one step below I always run Shimano XT.
Yeah.
I have never run Shimano XTR. And I think Shimano XT is just like a workhorse. It's good price. It's good weight.
Yeah.
It's been around forever and it's always good. It's just, you can always count on it. The hardtail came spec'd with SRAM and it's like GX or something, which I think is their third level. So it's like XX1, XO1. I forget how their levels go.
Yeah.
But it always just feels a little more clicky. Like, Like it works just fine, but it's not as smooth. It's like clunk, clunk.
Okay.
But I don't have any problems with it. My biggest problem too is that the triggers, like the XT trigger, it's push pull.
Yeah.
And I use that a lot more than I think I would. Whereas the SRAM is just push. No. It's put. Both are push pull, but the XT lever. I can't even remember. Let me think here. There's the one that you pull. You can also push. And you can't do that on SRAM, and it makes me crazy.
Oh, okay.
So if all I ever rode was SRAM on both bikes, I wouldn't notice it. But because I have one of each, I notice it. But yeah, I know. I mean, everybody loves SRAM, so it's not. I mean, that's another one of those things where it's kind of like, eh. I mean, I'll get over it. I'll switch to it. But yeah. I mean, if I could still find Shimano XT, I'll still run it any chance I get. And you can still buy it. It's not like it's not out there. But most people aren't specking bikes.
Yeah. And the XTR stuff, I mean, like, unless you're a professional racer, are you going to know the difference between XT and XTR?
I mean, you do the cost to weight savings analysis, and it's never going to come out. It's never going to come out in my favor.
Yeah. Same thing with the SRAM, what you just described, the weight to price, you know, difference between XX1 and XO1. It's like, okay, we're talking about 20 grams here.
Well, and you know, I'm 20 pounds overweight, so it's like go to the bathroom and lose 20 grams. I mean, I can't, you know, I'm not made of money anymore and I'm fat, so it's like I can't really justify XTR.
And if they keep making the XT, well, there you go.
Oh, I'm telling you. I mean, I've run Shimano on every bike I've ever had, and the Altegra road group is the same way. You know, the Dura Ace is the top of the line road group. I've never ever in my life used it. Altegra's always been my favorite thing. I've actually had some road bikes with 105 stuff, which I don't even know if it's still around, but that was always a workhorse group.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that's the nice thing about Shimano is it is well engineered, and a lot of that stuff will last a long time.
Yeah. I mean,
I think SRAM's doing just as good a job now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can't go wrong with it. It's like the difference between Fox and RockShox. It's like, okay, they both make really good stuff, you know?
Yep.
Are you going to pay a little bit more for Fox? Yeah, probably. But.
Yeah. And see, I have such a hard time comparing it because I've got my Shimano setup on my full suspension is all Fox, and the SRAM is on the hardtail with a RockShox. And I think mostly because I just don't love riding a hardtail, I have a lesser opinion of SRAM and RockShox because of it.
Yeah.
Which is stupid, right? Like, I'm guessing if I had a full suspension spec with RockShox and SRAM, I'd probably be perfectly happy with it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I think you should look at both the Kona Heihei and the, if there's a short travel trance.
Yeah. And if there's a short travel trance, that kind of changes things.
Yeah. I thought there was something kind of in the middle, but that may have been last year too.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can get last year's models too. So.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with those. Cause I think the stump jumper I was looking at is an older model. But Steve was telling me Specialized only redoes their product lines every 3 years. And he said the Stumpies are in their third year right now. So he said they probably won't do a 27 and a half next year.
Yeah.
So it's like, ooh, I better get my hands on that now.
Get on it. Get on it.
I know. So well, I don't.
You've given me a lot to think about now.
Yeah, I don't know if that was going anywhere where you wanted it to.
No, that's definitely.
I'm a little lonely, Dan. I haven't talked to anybody in weeks.
Well, hey.
So thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again for sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
So awesome. Where's your podcast? Like how to?
Oh, did you hear that? I keep banging my table here.
Oh, sorry.
But yeah, so let's wrap it up and then let's talk off air.
Okay.
So yeah,
that's good.
This was great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan. It was fun.
All right.